This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for April 1st, 2016. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Andrea Adamo talks about shrinking pharmaceutical factories. And David Grimm is here with a roundup of stories from our daily news site. And now, a brief technical note and thanks. I really want to thank our listeners who called and wrote for their help diagnosing a problem with downloading the podcast on mobile devices. The problem is fixed. So thanks again. And now you know, contacting us works. If you ever want to get in touch, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Now we have David Grimm, editor for our daily news site. He's here to talk about some recent online stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on the spread of yeast around the globe. As humans have populated the planet, we've brought many things to new lands. Animals, food, and yes, yeast. The study we're going to talk about today looks specifically at the spread of the yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And I can actually say this word because it's often used in research, genetics, evolutionary studies, things like that. But Dave, it has other tastier uses, right?
Right. Well, we use it in many fermented foods and in drinks, including wine, beer, coffee, and chocolate. I guess chocolate's not really a drink, but it's used in chocolate as well.
Did you know that coffee and chocolate were fermented? I learned that from this study.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's amazing. And yeast is key. These non-scientific uses of yeast lead to this method that enabled the researchers to track yeast all over the planet and map it without actually going to those locations.
Right. Instead of actually having to go to a lot of countries and just grab the yeast, all the yeast they could find, they did something a lot more, well, maybe not a lot, a lot more fun, but a lot easier. They bought coffee and chocolate from around the world. And the reason is because those things contain the yeast that they're looking for. And what they were trying to figure out is if they genetically sequenced the yeast that was present in this coffee and chocolate, could they figure out a pattern of how this yeast had got to where it is in the world.
I can imagine, you know, the receipts that you have to turn in. Once they harvested all of these wild yeasts, what did they learn from their genomes?
What they found was that the migration patterns of the yeast, if you can call them that, actually closely matched what we know about ancient human migrations, which suggests that as we were spreading out, as our species was spreading out across the world, we were taking these strains with us, and these strains changed just as we changed, depending on the parts of the world that we ended up in. So, for example, the Colombian coffee strain is a genetic mixture of North American oak and European wine yeast populations, which reflects the contact of the old and the new worlds during the European settling of the Americas. And Yemeni coffee, on the other hand, is fermented by yeast that is a mixture of European wine yeast and an Asian strain. And that makes sense because the Eastern and Western yeasts might have mingled as traders carried wine and coffee along the Silk Road, which was the ancient trade route that connected Europe and Asia.
Does this genetic diversity around the world affect the way coffee and chocolate from these different places taste?
The researchers think it does, although they didn't specifically test that question. But what we do know is yeast can play an important role in the flavor of a variety of these foods. And so you would imagine that as the yeast changes, the flavor is changing, which could explain the different types of flavors we're seeing in coffee and chocolate, etc., depending on where it comes from.
Next up, we have a story on falling rocks. If you'd asked me before I read this story, why do rocks fall? I would have said gravity and moved on with my life. But no, there's much more to it than that. What's the big mystery here?
We have something called rock falls, which happen all over the globe, where we have these multi-ton slabs of rock that pop off the face of a cliff with little or no warning. They careen down the side of a mountain or cliff and shatter in a cloud of geological shrapnel. It sounds pretty dramatic, and it is. But what's even more interesting is that at least 15% of these rock falls, we have no idea why they happen.
Right. So for this study, the researchers were like, we're going to just focus on one rock and figure
this out.
They just watched one rock for, I think, 3 years. What kind of observations did they make with their, well, it's not quite a rock cam, but, you know, with their instruments?
What the researchers looked at was a near vertical slab. This was a 10 centimeter thick, 20 metric ton layer of granite along a south facing cliff in Yosemite National Park. And they had various gauges, even lasers on it, that every few minutes were basically looking for very subtle deformations in the rock. And again, they were looking at this piece of rock for more than 3 years.
And spoiler alert, the rock did not fall down.
It did not fall, but it did bulge a little bit. And what the researchers noticed was that when there were big changes in temperature, they noticed these really subtle deformations in the slab. Humidity didn't seem to make a big difference, and the absolute temperature didn't make a big difference. It was if you had a day where maybe, say, it was really cold in the morning and really warm in the afternoon, that seemed to cause the greatest amount of deformation in this rock.
So this particular rock was busier, perhaps, than expected. But what about all the rockfall data? You said there was this mysterious 15%. Does this line up with that?
It does, at least for a large percentage of that 15%. When the researchers looked back at these rockfalls, they found a similar correlation where it seems like a lot of these events were happening when we did have these big changes in temperature throughout the day.
Lastly, we have a story on measuring gravity. This last story is on a new and improved gravimeter. Let's just start there. What is a gravimeter?
As you might expect, a gravimeter is a device that measures gravity. And they do this in one of two ways. They either measure the time it takes for an object to fall a certain distance, or they measure the distance that a certain weight stretches a spring. In either case, what these devices are doing is basically seeing how much of a tug Earth's gravity is having on the device, and that gives a sense for Earth's gravity in various spots of the globe. You would expect Earth's gravity to be the same everywhere, but there actually can be minute fluctuations based on the density of the rock or other material below. Say you have a very large tunnel or maybe a large amount of liquid in a particular area that can have subtle perturbations on gravity.
What's wrong with gravimeters as they are today? Why do we need an improved one?
Well, they're really big. They're about the size of a car battery or bigger, and they're really expensive. They can cost more than $100,000. So if you're a scientist trying to find something that's very portable that you could use a lot of places and it's not a pain to lug around, what we've got today isn't that practical.
Have these limitations been overcome with the new model that I've been hinting at this whole time? What makes it different?
So it's really tiny. It's only about the size of a postage stamp, and it's made out of silicon, and it's carved so that in its center, there's this 25 milligram bit of material that's left suspended by three fiber-like structures. And what happens is these structures all together sort of act like a spring. And so you've got this tiny little blob or bleb of an object, which can react to even very small changes in Earth's gravity. So small, in fact, that it can detect being lifted a mere 3 millimeters. Now, what does that mean in practice? That means that It can track the up and down motions of Earth's surface caused by the changing positions of the sun and the moon. These really tiny changes in our planet.
Now that there's a tiny, portable, super sensitive version of this device, what can it actually be used for?
Oh, a lot of great stuff, Sarah. So for example, if you had a hidden drug tunnel, as I said before, these tunnels can change gravity very subtly. Also mineral deposits, places where you would have maybe gold, silver, things like that. Even detecting volcanic tunnels or the flow of magma could potentially provide an early warning system for volcanic eruptions. And the idea is one way these could be used is that because they're so small, you could put them on a drone that would circle a particular area and give you very sensitive gravity readings.
Okay, what else is on the site this week?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about the mysterious hobbit. This is an ancient human-like creature that lived in what is today Indonesia. We've also got a story about whether social smarts make creatures smarter overall, and that includes animals like lions, hyenas, and even us. Finally, for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a Q&A with a scientist who's studying dementia atop Mount Everest. Also, a story about why Ebola is no longer a public health emergency. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. The current approach to synthesizing pharmaceuticals is slow, inefficient, and can result in shortages for many reasons. I spoke with Andrea Adamo about his effort to compress a drug factory into a box the size of a household refrigerator.
The first thing that is really unique of the device, it's its own idea per se. The idea of having a portable system to make drugs that is small. I think this is completely new in the landscape. One feature is the portability, and that comes in size. It needs to be small to be considered portable. The flexibility of operation, I think, is a second point. So by flexibility, I mean the fact that you can use the system to make different drugs. We also call it reconfigurability because the system can be configured for different processes to make different things. Another feature is the fact that it's on demand. So since the system is small and also because of the way it's built, you can produce things when you need them. You just need essentially power supply and starting materials, reagents, and then you turn it on and you make your drug. Another thing that makes it stand out a little bit more technically is the continuous approach that was selected for enabling this. There's already a number of continuous approaches that have been reported in the literature, so it's not totally new, but what is new is leveraging this approach for more sophisticated operation. The relevant thing is that, you know, this has never been done before. Drugs are made in centralized facilities, and there's a stiff planning calendar because, you know, you make huge amounts of them. And so there's a supply chain that is not very flexible. There's other issues that come with that in terms of storage, quality control, shelf life. The idea of having something flexible on demand that can be deployed pretty much anywhere brings new possibilities on the landscape.
Yeah, so that really gets to my first question, which is, what are some of the big problems that a small, agile, reconfigurable drug factory could solve? And so you said it can save you from your own supply chain problems. Anything else you can think of?
The supply chain problem is relevant, especially for addressing shortages. So there's a few things to keep in mind. Drugs can run out, as anything else on a shelf. Last year, for instance, there were about 200 drugs that were declared in shortage by the FDA. So if you have a flexible way to produce them, you know, you could address them on demand. Stocking material, things have shelf life, so that impacts the logistics. Cold chain, so there are drugs, products that have to be kept cold. That has impact on cost. This is true in general. There's also concerns for public safety. You know, the government stores up drugs should there be, you know, some outburst of a disease. It's easier to store reagents than to store the final product. At least the reagents, you know, if you get close to the end of the shelf life, you can use them for something else. The final product, you have just to throw it out. There's also the ability to relocate the factory. So let's say you want to send it to a remote area, you know, an area where you have a natural disaster. or some area of the globe that for whatever reason isn't the need for drugs. So these are the type of problems that flexible and agile factory can address.
One of the things that makes this a unique system also is that it's continuous production. It's not batch production.
Yes.
Can you contrast, you know, in a more general way, the difference between batch processing and continuous flow processing?
The best way to understand batch and continuous, the difference is to think of the assembly line. So Ford invented the assembly line for cars a little over 100 years ago. Instead of taking one car and building it from the first nut to the last piece, you know, and then turning on the engine, you have stations, and at each station, there's something else that gets added. So in continuous manufacturing with molecules, you do the same. Things travel in pipelines, in ducts. They flow in different locations, so in different reactions units or processing units, you do different operations. So you build as you go. And this allows you to have much tighter control on quality, reproducibility, and also expanding parameter space. So it's easier to pressurize a pipe than pressurize a vessel. In batch, what you do, you take a big vessel, you take a batch, and then you add this, and then you add that, and you keep on steering. Batches work very well. I mean, chemistry has been built on that. But, you know, when you go to large-scale production, batches become huge. And, you know, if you have a pool and you add a dye, you know, it's not everywhere. It takes a while until all the pool becomes red. Things have to diffuse. And so you can quickly see how disuniform a batch can be as opposed to something where things flow. And in each section, you have a small amount of material at a given point in time.
Why has it taken so long for pharmaceuticals to move in this direction? I know other kinds of chemicals are made in a continuous way.
There's plenty of chemicals that are made in continuous way. So what is new is not continuous per se. What is new is applying continuous to high added value molecules. I think there's mainly cultural reasons, first of all. So traditionally in the pharmaceutical world, you know, what you make is so valuable that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're going to have some waste because the value of the final molecule outweighs any waste or loss of efficiency. Also, you know, some of the passages are really delicate in the process. Why would you bother to change the way you are doing things? You know it really well, so you stick to that. So a paradigm change needs usually stronger driving forces. So I think one of the driving forces has come from the fact that pharma now wants to control a little bit better the spending and is interested in more robust processes. One of the reasons for that is also quality control. A continuous approach allows you to have better products in the end because the flow process is inherently more repeatable than a batch one.
For the paper, you made four different drugs in the same machine. Yeah. What did you make?
So for the paper, we made diazepam that is commercially known as Valium, so it's for relaxing people. Then we made fluoxetine that is an antidepressant. We did Benadryl that is anti-allergic, and we did lidocaine that is an anesthetic.
What is the state of these drugs when they come out the other end of the device? Are they ready to consume? And is this something where you can install this in a hospital and then all of a sudden you're just making those drugs there in the hospital?
So they are ready to consume, to be consumed. The current formulation is liquid. So, you know, there's a vial that comes out. And yes, you can put it in an hospital. Of course, not the specific version because, you know, this is at the stage of R&D, the project. But that's exactly the vision, you know, something that gives a high level of quality that FDA would approve and can be used for some administration of drugs.
Now, that brings up a really interesting point to me is how does this fit with the way drug manufacturing is regulated? Is continuing processing something that they're okay with? And if there were all these little drug factories out there, is that going to be a big change in the way drugs are regulated?
So as far as I know, FDA has been in support of continuous manufacturing. They do recognize the benefits on the technical ground. So I think in principle, this has room to grow and, you know, enable the vision that you just suggested. How that is going to play out exactly is hard to say at this point. But indeed, there is interest to push this forward and make it robust enough. And if you can keep a very elevated standard, why not having thousands of factories around?
Right. Well, what's your vision for this? Is this approach likely to replace the way a large number of drugs are produced now? Are you going to see it spread out into all different aspects of pharmaceuticals? Or is there going to always be like certain kinds of chemistry that just need more complicated processing that can't be boxed up into a refrigerator?
So I think that flow will keep on growing. The continuous flow approach will grow substantially. I would say from a technical standpoint, you want to use the best tools that you have. If it happens that there's certain things that in batch come out better, of course you want to do them in batch. So maybe it will not be displaced completely. But for the growth, you know, you have to identify what are the hurdles for adoption. I think the first one is a cultural change. All the people that are out there are essentially trained in batch. They've built a career on batch. So it takes a while to really understand the new approach, endorse it, and use it. And the other one has to do with investments that have been made. So building a production facility is an expensive proposition. So if you've invested in a facility, you want to use it probably 20, 30 years. So, you know, you have to look at the life cycle of equipment that is out there for a replacement. But I do think that it will grow substantially. And looking at the growth of literature, conferences in the field, the interest from large pharmaceutical companies, it looks like that is indeed the case.
Is this going to make pharmaceuticals less expensive?
That's really hard to say. So on the production standpoint, you do have cases where you can get a lower cost production. But what happens in the pharmaceutical industry is that the pricing is not related only to the production cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually driven by a lot of other things, including the development effort. Typically, the clinical trials cost a fortune. And so the company has to recoup on that. And then they want to make their profit, of course.
Andrea, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
Andrea Adamo and colleagues write about small, portable drug factories in this week's issue. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and many other places, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.